This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 296 was recorded on November 4th, 2021. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Escrow.com, the world's most secure online payment system from a counterparty risk perspective because the funds sit in escrow. Simplify Asset Management Chief Strategist Mike Green returns as this week's feature interview guest. We'll start with a review of this week's Federal Reserve announcements, including the Fed's comments on inflation and asset purchase tapering. Then we'll move on to the question of where digital currency is headed and who will be in control. We're going to experiment with a format change this week, adding an editorial by yours truly. This week's editorial topic will be the badly misunderstood and often misused term hyperinflation. Why most of the people using that word really don't know what they're talking about, and what's important to understand in the coming secular inflation, which is not likely to be a hyperinflation. Then be sure to stay tuned for our postgame segment when Patrick's chart deck is titled Going Parabolic.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Eric, let's jump right into it. That S&P 500 and particularly the NASDAQ have really accelerated in this post-FOMC. What's your take on all of this?
Well, Patrick, I really am coming around to appreciate that although I don't think any of this is organic or about a healthy economy, I think it's all about central bank largesse. I think that this acceleration to the upside in equity futures is really because the Fed statement this week was much more dovish than expected. Mike Green is going to cover that in detail, so I don't want to steal his thunder. We'll save it for Mike.
All right. Well, let's move on to that U.S. dollar index because it continues to hover to the top end of multi-month ranges and the euro continues to break down. What's your take on the dollar?
Really nothing to add this week, Patrick. You know, it's the same thing we've been saying. We're in that trading range. We're consolidating sideways. Until we see a decisive breakout above 94.5, we're just consolidating.
All right. Well, let's move on to crude oil because quite a bit of volatility in the last 2 days. What's your take on the price action here?
Yeah, there's really a huge amount of volatility. Now, I'm still super bullish in the long term, but I think what we're seeing is there's been a huge, huge fear that Cushing, Oklahoma was going to run out of oil, or at least run out of deliverable oil. I don't have any inside knowledge on exactly what's happening, but I can look at the futures term structure, and oh boy, the backwardation across the curve, even in the back of the curve, is just collapsing. So what this means is the market is suddenly thinking that you know, oil's just not going to be that tight of supply after all. So I think that's a combination of some expectations, perhaps, that the White House will eventually succeed in pressuring OPEC to increase supply, and perhaps also the expectation that asset tapering, when it does occur, might slow the economy some, and that might reduce demand. So what we're seeing is backwardation collapsing across the curve, and that's also bringing down the front month price. Couple of really big, heavy down days and a lot of volatility. Boy, this today was a real roller coaster ride in WTI crude oil futures.
How did the inventory numbers come in?
Crude oil building 3.3 million barrels nationally, but still drawing down 916,000 barrels in Cushing, Oklahoma. Now, that's the trend we've been very concerned with, Cushing drawing down even when there's a national build. The thing is, even though it's still happening, if I look at what those time spreads are telling me, all of a sudden the market is not as afraid as it was before. Meanwhile, it's a mixed bag on the finished products with gasoline drawing down 1.5 million barrels and distillates building 2.2 million barrels. U.S. production up 200,000 barrels to 11.5 million barrels. So we're fully recovered from Hurricane Ida and moving up to new, not all-time highs, but certainly cycle highs post-pandemic. Looks like the fear in Cushing in the time spreads is reversing. Now, if you really felt lucky, those front of curve time spreads that just blew out to the moon all the way up to $1.85, $1.90, something like that, they're back down around $1.15, $1.16. If we do not run out of oil in Cushing, those time spreads are going to, you know, by the time those contracts expire, they'll be back down to 60, 75 cents or less. The thing is, if we do run out of oil in Cushing, they could go to $5 easily or more, almost instantaneously. So, boy, that's a really dangerous trade, but could be a lucrative one if you get it right.
All right, well, let's touch on gold. While we're stuck in that multi-month trade range, it was interesting because yesterday we did see, before the FOMC, a breakdown that looked like gold was ready to go for another downtrend, but a pretty sharp reversal today in that post period. We're back approaching 1800. Does this change your view at all on gold, or is it pretty much still in the same view?
Well, I'm still skeptical as to where gold is really headed because, as you say, the expectation that the Fed was about to taper, and they are going to taper, but they weren't quite as hawkish as people thought they would be. The expectation of a hawkish announcement seemed to have gold taking a nosedive, getting ready to maybe, you know, head to new cycle lows. Who knows what was about to happen? Then the Fed came in much more dovish than expected. We didn't really see a big reaction in gold on the day of after the FOMC statement. It wasn't until today that it retraced, and it retraced to not quite as high as it was 3-4 days ago. You know, it didn't really get above the 100 and 200 day moving averages, which have been the critical resistance. So we still don't have a breakout even on a dovish Fed report. Whereas look at equities, you know, flying to the upside on the dovish Fed. So I really think that you have to, we ought to get Ronnie Sterfeli back on the program at some point. I really think you have to acknowledge that regardless of whether you agree or disagree with the cryptocurrency, you know, investment thesis, the fact is it's taking a lot of market share away from gold. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, everybody's got their opinion. But I think gold investors have to look at this and say, wait a minute, we got the call right when we said big inflation is coming and that has to be good for gold. Except guess what? The inflation showed up, the has to be good for gold hasn't really panned out yet. So I think what's really happening here is we've got to accept that a lot of people think that cryptocurrency is the new gold, and that it means that gold is losing its market share.
All right, well, let's just touch on that 10-year Treasury yield because we did see almost a 10 basis point pullback in the post-FOMC period. We're approaching 150 on the downside of the yield. Do you think that the Fed really changed the direction of bonds here, or is are interest rates just consolidating that big run before?
Patrick, I don't think you can say that we know for sure that the Fed changed anything. I think that the market was headed back toward that sort of danger zone area, thinking that the taper announcement might be more hawkish than it was. When it came in more dovish, then you saw, you know, a pretty natural retracement back down. I think we've got to watch what happens from here, and particularly once they really do start tapering, whenever that turns out to be. We'll get a briefing from Mike Green on that.
Well, this week's feature interview guest is Simplify Asset Management's chief strategist, Mike Green. Eric, why did we get Mike back on the show this week?
We haven't had Mike on in a long time. We've gotten a lot of feedback from our listeners who disagreed with some of his cryptocurrency views in his previous interview. So I wanted to give him a chance to do an update on that and talk about where he sees digital currency going. He's also an expert on monetary policy and a perfect person to comment on today's interview about this week's FOMC release.
Well, Eric's interview with Mike Green is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
This episode of Macro Voices was brought to you by Abex, a fintech company traded under ticker symbol ABXXF on the OTCQX in the United States and ABXX on the Equitas NEO in Canada. Abex was founded on the principle of creating market-based solutions to solve the world's most challenging problems. Two of these issues in particular, the energy transition and climate change, are creating once-in-a-generation opportunities for investors. Abex is leveraging proprietary Web 3.0 technologies to digitize and accelerate the velocity and security of commodity trading markets, beginning with liquefied natural gas and carbon. Investors seeking exposure to the fintech applications powering this new era of the ESG economy can visit www.abex.tech or www.abex.exchange, or check out ABXX on the Equitas NEO or ABXXF on the OTCQX exchanges.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Mike Green, Chief Strategist and Portfolio Manager for Simplify Asset Management. Mike, it's great to have you back on the show. We had the big day today on Wednesday afternoon. We're recording this the day before this podcast airs. The Fed announced that they're intending to do what? Why don't you give us the full briefing of what the Fed did today and what it means and what you see on the horizon?
Well, I think the easiest way of just describing what happened today with Jerome Powell's testimony and the release statement is that the Fed came out more dovish than I think people had broadly expected them to. They indicated that, yes, they will begin tapering. They have the ability to either back off or to accelerate against that. But I think the most important piece of information that came away from it was the Fed's continued emphasis on the fact that they believe inflation is transitory. And importantly, even in the labor market, which has traditionally been thought of as a key driver of the Fed's behavior, that they do not see us as having normalized or come anywhere close to reaching full employment. And they're largely discounting many of the wage pressures that they're seeing. You know, Powell was relatively humble in terms of the certainty of where they are, but I think it was somewhat unequivocal that this was a very dovish presentation. And the real question, I think, is going to be how credible does the street view the uncertainty around whether they should hike or not, right? The direct words were, when we reach full employment, then we'll figure out whether we're addressing the inflation components, whether we've adequately met the inflation objectives. And I think that's a pretty important statement. One of the very first times, you almost would have expected something like this out of, you know, a labor economist like Yellen, but Powell very clearly came out in favor of let's let the economic environment run hotter as we try to get people back into the labor force.
What is this going to mean for, let's start with equity markets?
Well, equity markets obviously are enthusiastic about it. We've seen a bit of a, you know, sharp rally in terms of U.S. equities in particular. It appears to be led, you know, by many of the larger stocks, so not necessarily a remarkable move in terms of either inflation-oriented assets, and obviously that's being affected by some dynamics that are going on in the commodity markets, as we'll probably talk about later. But you're broadly seeing this dynamic of, you know, the traditional leaders of the market, the large cap names, are rising. My guess is that that's a function of people trying to put money to work rapidly. So buying the S&P 500 futures, for example, or buying the NASDAQ 100 futures with the objective of trying to put money quickly to work. And then we'll shake that out over the next couple of days as people try to decide how they want to actually fully deploy that capital.
Well, you mentioned commodity impact. Let's talk about that next, because gold took a real nosedive, but it looks like it retraced almost half of that move. Crude oil, on the other hand, just kept on nosediving.
Yeah, so to me, those are interesting, right? So gold is more inflation in terms of monetary sensitive or real rate sensitive. I would argue that, you know, I've been concerned about crude for a while, primarily because I think that China is significantly weaker than people think. And that is the primary market for crude, right? So yes, we're absolutely affected in the United States. We are absolutely looking at a situation where high crude oil prices are influencing our economic behavior and have suggested that we would see inflationary conditions. I guess what I've been trying to reiterate, and I've said it over and over and over again on Twitter, part of what we need to remember in commodity markets is that China's the largest consumer. They're slowing dramatically. It's very unclear what 2022 is going to look like once we clear many of the supply challenges here in the United States, to a lesser extent in Europe. There's been an awful lot of goods demand that has been pulled forward. And as China is, you know, slowing in its economy, the crude markets are going to be pressured on that front. So again, it's a supply issue. And you see that, I would argue, at least in terms of the construction of the curve, which has been very sharply in backwardation, right? So at the front of the curve, we're looking at, you know, $80 oil at the back of those, and that's $4 down from where it was, you know, earlier today. At the back of the curve, you know, 2 years out, 3 years out, we're still looking at $60 oil. So this is a market that is very clearly saying this is a short-term issue. And now I'd suggest that there's some uncertainty coming around in terms of what the potential demand curve looks like.
Why do you see that uncertainty? Is that China or something else?
China is the area that I'm most concerned about in commodities. And, you know, the other component, I guess, I would highlight is in very classical terms, the cure for high prices is high prices. What everybody had kind of hoped for was that cure was going to manifest itself in terms of higher production. In other words, the U.S. was going to tool back up in terms of its supply dynamics. We've seen resistance on that, and obviously we've seen the Biden administration push back against the idea of expanding fossil fuel production in the United States. I think that had led people to think that we are going to see the potential for, you know, I believe we heard Goldman Sachs come out with a call for a potential spike to $120 next year a few days ago. My sense is that that is unlikely to happen if China continues to slow.
Let's talk about the big one, which is fixed income treasury yields. Of course, the big fear was, hey, if this is really the beginning of the next taper tantrum, you could be looking at a bond market crash. Well, we got a much more dovish statement, but still they are talking about tapering. So which way does this go in terms of bond yields?
Well, and I think we've talked about this before, right? So the question is, how much should bond yields actually reflect inflation fears, the current level of inflation fears, versus a longer term question about the stability and the inflationary conditions? I don't think, and I think Powell actually speaking to this, what he told us very specifically is we're not in any rush to hike in the near term. We're waiting until we actually see the economic behavior. And we have seen some, you know, increase in yields in reaction to that, right? That dovish statement did result in bond yields rising by about 3 basis points. But we're a long way away from a bond crash. And it's important to just highlight for people that while it feels like 157 on the U.S. Treasury, the 10-year, is ridiculously low, that's actually quite high on a global basis. So I struggle with a lot of the interpretation that people have had that we're going to have a bond crash because the Fed steps away and stops buying. I'm actually just about to post a piece on Medium talking about the dynamic of who is buying bonds. And I think people underappreciate the unique role that bonds play in portfolios. They are unique amongst financial assets in offering certainty about future value in nominal terms. Other assets behave very, very differently. And so there's always going to be demand for bonds in portfolios. The idea that it's just going to collapse because people are fearing, you know, Jack Dorsey's, you know, hyperinflation is coming, that's going to be a long time before we actually end up seeing that dynamic play through.
Mike, you mentioned your Twitter audience. You know, you get beaten up a lot, both on Twitter and when you've been on this show before. I think a lot of people think you are the, the crypto antichrist or something. I want to try to set a record straight. I want to ask you some true or false questions, and I think that the answers are probably going to surprise our listeners. So, Mike, in your opinion, true or false, the invention of the tokenized secure digital bearer asset, that's the underlying invention that makes Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies and also decentralized finance possible, is it true to say that that is an utterly game-changing invention which will completely reshape the face of finance over the next 25 years?
True.
You crypto guys that don't like Mike weren't expecting that one, were you? Let's take it the next step. Is it true that it is a near certainty that conventional currency systems will eventually be replaced by tokenized digital currency systems because they are inherently superior and offer so many benefits that we just can't possibly resist long-term the temptation to replace all conventional currency with tokenized digital currency?
True.
You guys weren't expecting that from Mike, were you either? And is it also true that the benefits that these things offer substantially reduce counterparty risk and the systemic risks that have inherently plagued the financial system for years? Specifically, you think about the so-called Lehman moment, where one institution can take down the entire system because of how deeply its counterparty risk goes. Is it true that decentralized finance, that's the application of that secure digital bearer asset, not just to currencies, but actually to all of the other securities, creates an entirely new financial system that's based on assets rather than institutions, and we don't have to have systemic risk that's tied to any one institution?
I'm going to give that one a partially true one, because I think the design of that system, there's a choice. The current system relies on and this is very well described by a very unpopular individual right now, Omarova, the idea that what we have now is we have a banking system. We have a currency system that relies on agents of the government, not actually members of the government, but effectively the banking system and the shadow banking system to create most of the money that we see. The uncertainty about the quality of those counterparties is what you're referring to, and the crises associated with that is what you're referring to. I agree with you that it is likely that that will change radically with the introduction of tokenized and digital securities.
So with tokenized securities and a tokenized financial system, we can really make a better mousetrap, a better financial system that has less systemic risk, more transparency. It's a better thing. It is the way of the future. You and I agree on that, don't we?
Yes, 100%.
Okay. Now, I think this is where we really have to draw the line and just say the only place where you and I don't necessarily agree with the Bitcoin maximalist crowd is the idea that it will continue to be possible for private actors, that's basically the developers all around the world that contribute to the creation of the Bitcoin network. What I've predicted and you've predicted is that governments will eventually wake up and recognize that, hey, these guys are not the bunch of jokers that the central bankers have described them at. They really do pose a threat to the government's monopoly over the issuance of currency. And eventually, you and I have predicted that governments will figure out, hey, if we don't do something about these guys, they really will replace all government-issued money with something better, because they have come up with something better. The only place where you and I disagree with the crypto crowd is we think that governments eventually will wake up and recognize they're about to lose that monopoly, and they'll probably freak out in a way that is extremely damaging to the privately issued cryptocurrencies that are designed to compete with government-issued money. Is that the gist of it?
Yes, and I would go a step further, right, and say that, you know, where my concern lies is mostly in that reaction function and the fact that it could end up much worse, right? And if that recognition is delayed and we develop effectively a shadow currency system or a shadow riskless asset system, shadow collateral system, that is in opposition to the interests of governments, and by extension, governments that are perhaps not competently pursuing it, but generally trying to do the right thing, in particular in the case of the United States, that the reaction function to that is going to be much worse. And so my biggest concern is the broad attitude of, you can't stop us. You know, you have no power over us. You can't regulate us. If you try to, we're just going to pick up and take our ball and go home and play somewhere else. I just don't think that that's a realistic proposal. And I think it becomes quite bad.
Well, now I'm really going to surprise our listeners. And part of this, I'm playing devil's advocate, but my, you know, my view is evolving. When I wrote my book on this 3 years ago, I said, look, there's no way governments are ever going to allow the monopoly over the issuance of money to be taken away from them by a bunch of hackers on the internet who came up with the invention of a better kind of money. What always happens when you invent a really cool weapon and try to oppose a really powerful government with it is they come and kill your soldiers and take your weapon away from you and copy it and use it for their own purposes. And I predicted that would happen. But I also said, you know, there is a certain point where it becomes politically very, very difficult to outlaw something if it is received already enough government endorsement where people have put their savings into it and so forth. And we've reached a point, Mike, where we have SEC-endorsed, blessed Bitcoin ETFs that people are putting their retirement savings into. It would be very difficult for the government to say, look, in the interest of national security, we have to ban this cryptocurrency stuff. And oh, the fact that a whole bunch of voting Americans put their life savings into this stuff through a regulated ETF that the SEC blessed, well, sorry, shit happens. I think it's already getting to the point where, although I do think that the stakes are so high that once governments figure out what really is at stake, they'll do what they have to do. But I think that the scenario I first saw where it's a very easy fight, there's not a lot of bloodshed. Governments just say, look, we're going to shut this thing down. The way we do that is we just outlaw the conversion. You know, we make it a crime for any bank to you know, convert anything into or out of it to facilitate any kind of exchange into or out of cryptocurrency between fiat currency and cryptocurrency. Just doing that makes it so impractical that it would really, really take a huge dent out of it. Well, it would be really hard to do that now politically, and it's getting harder. So at what point do you get to where it really becomes a major political bloodshed for the government to change its view on this thing?
I think two things. One is, again, it goes, and I, by the way, have had similar observations where my view is the best case scenario for the Bitcoin proponents, and again, this is going to draw massive amounts of hate, but it is that ultimately it turns into an executive order 6102 where the government says, here's the price that we will buy these assets from you for so that you don't experience a crippling loss. But it becomes a, you know, it doesn't become a pure taking in terms of it's forced to zero, but it does become a taking in the form of we will no longer allow this to develop. To me, that feels like the best case and is roughly, I think, what you're alluding to.
Well, I actually have a different view, and I don't think we're there yet. I think there is still room for governments to wake up and recognize the threat that a better currency system poses to their monopoly. But if it goes much farther, what I would anticipate is that governments realize they can't outlaw it, and so what they do is they simply, quote, regulate it, that's regulate in air quotes, meaning that they're basically going to say, you have to completely redesign it to do the opposite of what it does. You have to replace all of those wonderful privacy features of Bitcoin and make it so it's completely, totally traceable by the government. And if you don't do that, well, then it's illegal. And so we didn't outlaw it. We just said you had to add safety features to make it better. And of course, those features would really undermine what Bitcoin was actually designed to do. So I think they would force the fundamental change of what these things are in a way that undermines their design intention. And that would cause probably a fork where there's a bunch of people that say, I want to have legal cryptocurrency, whatever that means, and a bunch of other people who say, F that, we're sticking with the good old Bitcoin standard and let them try to shut us down. And I think they will shut them down eventually, but it'll be a difficult fight. And the days of where I used to think it would be easy for government to shut it down, I think those days are numbered, if not over.
So I think it's always been difficult to shut it down. And, you know, I think this has been one of the broad misunderstandings, right? It's nobody is arguing that it is easy to shut this down. You absolutely can, you know, start up a meth lab or start up a crypto mining rig and try to keep Bitcoin alive, right? There's no question about that. But the question for me is, do you want to bear the costs associated with that, right? There's remarkable rewards that accrue to somebody who opens up a meth lab in terms of monetary compensation. There's also remarkable penalties associated with getting caught doing it. And so it exists in our society, but it is not celebrated on CNBC. That, I think, I would argue that, unfortunately, I would agree with the way that you're saying it, that there is the potential for there to be a neutered asset that can be used as collateral, et cetera. You know, at Simplify, we actually offer exposure to Bitcoin and to crypto in ways that are consistent with the regulated environment. I don't know how that is going to play out. I can't know with absolute certainty. But the whole focus for us is on encouraging that people take a responsible allocation to it rather than treat it as this is the certainty. This is an unstoppable force. So I don't know exactly how it's going to play out. It obviously is stochastic and depends upon the reaction function. But there are lots of things that are illegal that have not been stamped out that I would guess the vast majority of people really, even though they can be profitable, really don't want to be involved with.
Well, I'm sure that might be true like meth labs, but we really are talking about a superior form of currency system. And, you know, I think that the reason that I have predicted and you've predicted that governments should object to it is it really is better, it dramatically better. And that means that their monopoly over the issuance of money is at risk if they allow it to continue. I'm astonished that most government officials and particularly central bankers have not figured out that reality. They certainly seem to have woken up to the need for central bank digital currencies, but they don't seem to realize that there is, I think, a very real risk if they don't get their act together that Ethereum or some other digital currency will reach a point where it really is very hard to stop.
I think that's, I mean, again, I agree. I'm not suggesting that it's going to be easy in the same way that it's not easy to stamp out all sorts of illegal activity. But I still don't see the scenario in which it is embraced. And that may be where we differ. I also would suggest that while I think that there are features around the tokenization and digital nature of the assets that are unique and superior to the attempts at tokenization that we have around the U.S. currency, for example, right? The serial numbers that exist on a dollar bill are a form of digitizing the asset, trying to create scarcity around that individual asset. Now, they're used ineffectively for tracing things like forgeries, counterfeiting, et cetera, but they are not in any way, shape, or form native to it. You cannot track it in the same manner. I think the point that I would broadly make around Bitcoin in that framework is that it is an asset that does a remarkably good job of one thing, which is if the government were to actually decide this is not okay, it would be very easy for the government to actually identify who are doing the things that are not okay. I think that's something that people need to take very, very seriously.
Let's take a step back then from Bitcoin and just talk about secure digital bearer assets, which you and I agree are going to completely change the face of finance and that really provide a way to create a far superior currency system that's much better than any conventional currency. Now, I know we've got a lot of listeners rolling their eyes saying, wait a minute, you know, the financial system's been digital for 30 years. You know, I do everything online, wire transfers, whatever. What is this tokenized? What is so special about this? Why is it actually so much better? Mike, other than a bunch of kids like it, what's so special about these tokenized, you know, currency dollars instead of just regular good old green dollar bills?
Well, the primary feature is actually that it allows you to, one, have a much more robust relationship between the government and most of its citizens. So many in the Bitcoin world highlight the challenge of the unbanked, right? That there are people who do not have access to financial services. Ultimately, digital securities allow you to create a individual relationship that doesn't require the outdated franchise relationship, again, to steal from an unpopular author, that is what we have in the banking system, right? So the banking system basically exists as an authorized entity that has the capability of tapping into the Federal Reserve, tapping into the actual core of the banking system, and does so by offering me assets that are the exact same thing that we see, by the way, in stock markets, where I don't actually own the stock. I am a semi-secured creditor of Merrill Lynch or Fidelity or JP Morgan in terms of a brokerage relationship. The same thing is true within the banking relationship. Absent the FDIC insurance, as a depositor, I am an unsecured creditor within that banking system. The digital token allows you to have a direct relationship where your claim is against the government itself. And so effectively, any abrogation of that becomes the equivalent of the government choosing to default. It's a much harder, much lower counterparty risk, as you were referring to earlier, transaction. Now, the fear, and this is a very valid one, is that when you replace that relationship, you've effectively created lots of small individuals against one giant bank. And that giant bank is presumed to have power and a willingness to use things like financial repression and inflation to, quote unquote, steal the money of the population. That's one of the things that I think is so caustic about the current narrative is that inherent lack of trust, right? Have they done the best job possible? Absolutely not. Have they done things to engender our trust? It's very debatable. Are the choices that they have made as irrational as they're often presented? I don't think so.
Now, I'm fascinated. You said that the principal benefit was that it allows essentially a direct digital relationship between the holder of currency and the government. I'm sure that a lot of the crypto audience is not going to enjoy that comment and say, wait a minute, it's not the government. It's specifically in the case of Bitcoin, not the government. So it really is the currency system that you have. You actually have a digital token that it can't be counterfeited. There, you don't have to worry about whether your bank goes under because you don't need the bank. You can keep your money in this digital tokenized system, which you might have a custodian for or you might not have a custodian for. It's secure. And once we get to tokenized assets, not just currencies, but also securities, you're using one tokenized asset to buy other tokenized assets. You don't have any counterparty risk or any custodial risk because you don't depend on a custodian to hold your stocks for you. They're actually, you know, in your name in the digital system, so to speak. But what you're saying is, well, you're making the assumption that the government is in charge of this digital system. Let's at least consider the possibility that what a lot of people are saying is, look, governments are slow and inefficient and screwed up. And what the Bitcoin crowd think they're doing is to create a better currency system. And it absolutely is better. Now, right now in its current implementation, using the proof of work based validation architecture, it's extremely inefficient in how it uses resources. That's all going to change. You know, the first version of any software, it always gets better over time. We'll eventually outdo proof of work with proof of stake based systems. It's going to get much more efficient with time. But the question is it valid to say, you know what, government's never going to do this. It's going to be the private sector that creates the new currency systems of the future. And, you know, it's probably not going to be Bitcoin, but it's going to be Facebook, whatever they're calling Libra these days, or it's going to be Google Money or Apple Bucks or whatever. It's going to be Silicon Valley that basically partners with the government and saying, look, you get let this crypto thing go too far. And now if you want to save it, you're not going to be able to save it with the pace of government. You're going to have to make a deal with us. You're going to have to make a deal with Google. And we'll create Google digital dollars, and you can bless them as United States Google digital dollars, and we'll be your vendor who's in charge of administering the global currency system that, by the way, we like being in charge of. I think that is a plausible scenario. Now, the one where Bitcoin, which is designed to intentionally alienate and offend government officials with the features that it has to, in order to allow people to hide their transactions from government oversight, I don't think that stuff's going to fly long term. I think it will eventually be outlawed. But the idea of a Silicon Valley giant like Apple or Google or even Facebook making a deal with the government saying, look, you guys let the cryptocurrency stuff get out of control. You got to have digital currency, but you got to get it at Silicon Valley pace, not Washington, D.C. pace. Sign us up. Is that realistic?
I think that's super realistic. I don't know that it necessarily is Silicon Valley, and I don't know that it's, you know, not some form of government contractor. For all intents and purposes, it could end up being Lockheed Martin, right? We don't know the answer. Now, I would suggest that Google is better positioned for it, or Facebook is better positioned for it than Lockheed Martin in this situation. But ultimately, I completely agree with you that the government fully recognizes that their inability to work at that pace that is required for that adoption is likely to push it into a public-private partnership. And if you want a very simple model for how that could work, right, just imagine effectively a base layer system that is provided free of charge to all members of our society. So every individual receives a social security number when they are born or when they become a U.S. citizen. And on the back of that, or an employee identification number when you become a company, on the back of that, you effectively have that as your bank account number sitting in a central repository that is then able to say, again, to use the today example for it, this piece of paper that we call a dollar bill that has this particular serial number, right? Now, add the richness of the digital tokenized format to that, sits in this account and is available to be spent by this individual. And there is no indication or no confusion about who actually owns and controls that, right? That base layer can be provided free of charge to everybody in our society. The next layer of service, let's say you are a corporation that wants to exceed a certain number of transactions or wants to access complex financial relationships, things like OTC derivatives, et cetera, then you have to pay for value-added services on top of that. That to me makes perfect sense. It feels like that's absolutely the direction that it's going.
I think that's the direction it's going to. I call them SVDCs for Silicon Valley digital currencies. And I suppose you're right, it doesn't have to be Silicon Valley, although I think that's the most likely origin of such a thing. And I really think, unfortunately for the Bitcoin crowd, it is going to be the absolute antithesis of Bitcoin. I think that some big Silicon Valley company, might be Facebook, might be Google, will get in bed with the government and design a digital currency system with features exactly the opposite of Bitcoin's design objectives. Every single transaction will be traced. You know, there'll be a permanent audit trail that allows the government to see exactly every penny of wealth that you've ever had, who you got it from, what circumstances you got it under, where it came from, where they got it from. It's all going to be traceable, and it's all going to be billed as a security feature that helps us to fight off terrorism. And all of Satoshi Nakamoto's goals are, they're going to use his technology to create something that achieves exactly the opposite goals. And I think it will be private industry, you know, something like Facebook's Libra growing into a government I don't know if it's sanctioned or government chartered thing, which eventually creates a private label digital currency that is adopted by several nations and becomes the new global reserve currency, replacing the US dollar. Now, if that happens, there are very significant consequences to the US dollar and the US currency system in losing reserve currency status. And, you know, that would have to all be factored into the plans. And right now, the planners don't seem to have figured out what Bitcoin is yet, like 15 years later. So I'm not sure this is all going to go down in a most perfectly efficient way. I don't know about you, but if there's one thing I do not want to see the George Washington dollar bill replaced with, it's a Mark Zuckerberg dollar bill. What could be the risks here?
So I think you just hit on a bunch of them, right? And this is part of the point that I make, and it tends to drive people a little reactionary, I guess, is the kind way of saying it. The U.S. has many faults and has made terrible policy choices. That's true for all countries. We tend not to pay attention to that for the very simple reason that they are much smaller on the global stage. The closest analog that we have to ourselves at this point is obviously China. And I think very few in the audience, even those who are Bitcoin maximalists, would argue that they would prefer to live under the Chinese system than the US system. The US is somewhat unique in its willingness to consider these alternative systems. And ironically, many in the United States, right, who politically value what they refer to as freedom, right? I'm skeptical that what Ted Cruz really wants is freedom, but to speak in that way are willing to consider systems that quote unquote weaken the government, right? The classic, you know, smaller government component. Again, we're kind of 40 years into the Reagan revolution, and they know that everyone is going to push back and say, you know, oh, well, the government's bigger than it's ever been sort of thing. The reality is that we've gotten to this point that we say the government accomplishes nothing good. And that's just not true, right? Governments exist for a variety of reasons, but the most important one is that they are representing the social will of the people in the case of an elected democracy or an elected representative government that, like we have in the United States. Do they do that particularly well? In many cases, they don't, right? But the alternative is much, much worse. And so when we engage in an attempt to tear down the US dollar and reduce the influence of the US on the global stage, the real risk is not that a Bitcoin emerges de novo and becomes this fantastic new standard under which we all become wealthy and happy simply by participating in the system. The risk is that that power vacuum is filled by far more nefarious elements.
Let's move on to the subject of stable coins generally, because I think as much as there's so much attention in hype and hoopla around Bitcoin and the cryptocurrencies, most people really don't want to take the speculative risk of betting on something, even if they're real true believers in where it's headed. You know, betting your life savings on an incredibly volatile asset class like Bitcoin, it's hard to sell most grown-ups on. On the other hand, if you're talking about the promise, and I emphasize the word promise, that is, if you believed the sales pitch on stablecoins, it's kind of got all the benefits of a digital currency system, and it's a tokenized asset. It exists outside of the institutionalized financial system. It, you know, it has all this cool stuff to it, but it's magically tied to just automatically, you know, like a money market fund. It just never breaks the buck. It always stays tuned to the US dollar. So, you know, you've got the stability of something like a money market fund, but it's all tokenized with all these benefits. Sounds like a perfect thing to put your whole life savings into, doesn't it? Well, you and I think no, but the reasons that you and I think no are really not obvious to the average retail investor, are they?
Well, I don't know that they are or they aren't, right? But effectively, what it really is counterparty risk, right? So we have no idea about the stablecoins that are in existence today in terms of what the actual assets that back them are. And the sponsors of these stablecoins, the Tethers, USDCs, et cetera, have completely failed, despite incredible opportunity to do so, to publish actually audited results, right? So telling us exactly what they own, what the assets that they own that back these assets are, what the degree of backing is. We just don't know. And there's no reason why they can't. And so you mentioned money market mutual funds, for example, right? Money market mutual funds are heavily regulated on every single day. Literally, actually, minute by minute, we can know what these things own. The filing dynamics of a Fidelity money market fund are going to tell us in excruciating detail, not only the individual securities that they own, but the broad classes, the liquidity characteristics, the interest rate that's being earned on those assets, et cetera. We have nothing equivalent in the stable coins that exist today. And that's what I think you and I ultimately object to, because there is a demand for this digital asset. It is a superior security to a dollar bill that exists in my pocket that I can only send you economically if you and I both happen to have banking relationships that allow us to easily transfer funds between ourselves, right? Now, that can occur over a Venmo, and it seems relatively simple. It can occur over a PayPal, or it can occur by my handing you a dollar bill, right? A stablecoin theoretically functions similarly in the digital world. The question is, we just don't know what they actually are. And that has always been the issue associated with these unregulated banking systems. It is an asset that we presume has stability that we really can't actually tell. And so it has very high what's referred to as jump to default risk. If it turns out that Tether is actually not money good, the risk is not that it's 99 cents. The risk is that it's 3 cents. That changes things, or 0 cents.
Well, I think this is really important, Mike, because first of all, a lot of people would say, you're crazy, you don't understand, Tether's perfectly fine. But based on what you've said, and I happen to agree with you, I'm not an expert on this, but what little I know of Tether is, you know, they've sort of kind of got a bank account in the Bahamas, kind of. Not sure I really think that meets my definition of a secure currency system or asset backing. But it seems to me like this concept of a stablecoin that is backed by a fully audited book of assets that fully secure those stable coins. So they really and truly are tied to the US dollar and they can't break the buck. I mean, all the technology exists to create that. It seems like the market for it is definitely there. You're saying Tether is not that, it, you know, seems like it's a fraud or it's a sham or it's a whatever. Why wouldn't somebody, I mean, why wouldn't your company create a better Tether that really and truly does have the assets? And it's not in the Bahamas. It's in a U.S. financial institution. It's fully audited by, a top shelf U.S. Audit firm. Why doesn't somebody create one of those?
Well, the simple answer is that's what Libra was supposed to be, right? And what they discovered with Libra, the idea was very straightforward under Libra, which is we're going to offer this stablecoin. We're going to create a deposit-taking institution that allows people to take their fiat currency, put it into a quote-unquote stablecoin, the Libra coin, and we're then going to benefit from the fact that we've taken in billions of dollars, which we can invest and earn a float for providing the services associated with that superior asset. What they discovered is in a world of zero and negative interest rates, man, that's not a very profitable business. And so this is part of the challenge that we have. Yes, absolutely, that's a service. In the same way that the US government loses money when it prints a dollar bill, right? It's far more efficient for them to create a digital one. Currency exists as a service to the US public. We lose money on nickels. We lose money on pennies. We lose money on dollar bills. Right? That's unfortunately where we would be in today's low interest rate world if somebody tried to offer that service. It costs more than you're generating in return from it.
Oh, I trust the boys at Facebook to figure out all sorts of hidden ways to make a buck that nobody really knows what's going on until it's too late. So I don't know that they can't make it profitable, but certainly if you did it above boards and advertised it was doing nothing more than be a stable coin, I agree that's not too profitable. But I think this really is the crux. Whoever is in charge of this, this goes back to the age-old issue of governments not being able to understand and keep up with technology. Whoever's in charge of this is going to have incredible power, and regulators in charge of regulating it aren't going to really know what's going on.
I tend to think that's true. I think, unfortunately, and this is absolutely true as it relates to something like Tether, when it exists and has grown in the manner that it has grown outside of a regulated system where there is no regulatory authority who has the ability to say, you must show us exactly what you own at every moment, or we at least have the ability to go in and take that. Because again, Tether is not regulated, right? They'll point to FinCEN, et cetera. FinCEN is not a regulatory body. It is a registration body. Meaning, in other words, it's just, hey, you know, give us your phone number, basically, and maybe we'll call you at some point in the future. When you have that type of framework, it encourages all sorts of bad behavior. The worst case scenario would simply be that Tether is just taking the funds and absconding with them. I think that's probably unlikely. The second alternative is that they are providing a service primarily to the unregulated exchanges that facilitate the banking relationships effectively that are required for people to trade crypto, because I have to put money into an exchange. I have to put money into an account in order to effectuate trades. The role of that in a stock market, for example, when your brokerage relationship is filled by the money market mutual fund, it becomes the zero base asset, the zero volatility base asset that allows me to comfortably exist within a Charles Schwab or a Fidelity. That's what they're effectively trying to create. And it's possible that they have relationships with the FTXs and the Krakens, et cetera, of the world, the Binances, where that's the service that they're providing, and they're charging a fee for it associated with it. And they're choosing to invest those assets in things that are more speculative than we would otherwise believe, right? That does create the potential for earning float. And there's a lot of rumors that float around things like Tether owns Chinese commercial paper. Again, we just don't know, right? We don't know. My hunch is that to the extent that they have backing by assets, it's ultimately just an IOU from their customers, the exchanges, right? You don't have a direct relationship with Tether. You have a relationship with Tether through an exchange. That's my hunch. My hunch is that to the extent there's assets there, it's effectively credit that is being extended to the exchanges. Whether that is good credit or bad credit is somewhat unknowable, but when you are dealing with unregulated exchanges, the risk of them becoming regulated and being shut down and those assets going to zero, and therefore everybody discovers that there's not enough assets to back the Tether component, are quite high. And it doesn't feel like people are aware of that or willing to accept the role that that might play.
Well, it seems to me that the real point here is we urgently need a true stable coin that is absolutely solidly backed and audited, and nobody questions whether it's a sham or not. And it seems like we don't quite have one yet.
Well, that's the whole point behind central bank digital currencies, right? Because it eliminates the question of, is it exchangeable for fiat in a one-for-one basis, right? I mean, the irony that I would argue within the Bitcoin community is the role of stablecoins in playing that and facilitating it exactly as we're describing, like a money market mutual fund within your Schwab account that allows you to buy and sell, right? Because you have to remember, when I buy Bitcoin, I need to have funds available to execute that immediately. When I sell Bitcoin, I need to have a place to put the proceeds. That's what a stablecoin fills, right? I don't actually have magically a ATM that then prints out US dollars from my computer. What I have is I have the ability to put it into a zero volatility asset on deposit effectively at that exchange or through that relationship. That we have absolutely no idea what's underpinning that theoretically stable asset. I don't understand how people don't understand how important that is. And the second thing that I would highlight is that there's an awful lot of language around the idea that this can't possibly be influencing Bitcoin in this manner. It absolutely can, right? Because this is the source of liquidity for a very illiquid asset.
Yeah, so
there's no question that can have a huge impact.
Yeah, it's to say that Tether has no impact on Bitcoin. It's to say that the US dollars have no impact on stock prices.
Correct.
Pay for them. 100%. Pay for them with US
right.
dollars.
And so a perfect illustration of this is actually what happened in 2008, right? So if you remember First Reserve, there are two issues associated with the failure of Lehman. One was a large money market mutual fund, First Reserve, held Lehman bonds. And because Lehman bonds, and again, money market mutual funds are regulated, they can only hold assets that have a certain rating. Because Lehman failed so quickly, it never had the opportunity to be downgraded. The process of downgrading the asset would have meant that it was transferred out of a riskless vehicle like First Reserve and sold at a very minor loss to the next person down the risk curve who would be willing to take some speculative risk or had the capability of taking some speculative risk. Because it was a very sizable component and this happened, First Reserve, quote unquote, broke the buck, right? That meant that people who were using money market mutual funds as collateral in leveraged relationships or who were relying on X amount of cash in their portfolios suddenly found themselves with less cash. That meant they had to sell stocks or other risk assets. The second source of the panic that occurred around the collapse of Lehman was many hedge funds had a relationship with Lehman as a prime broker, where what they thought was their cash was sitting at Lehman. And when Lehman failed, it actually turned out that they just became an unsecured creditor and had to step into the Lehman claims line, which meant they didn't have cash. And in order to transact and deal with things, you need cash. And so they had to sell securities. And when everyone has to do that together, you get the crash of Lehman.
Well, Mike, I can't thank you enough for another terrific interview. But before I let you go, tell us a little bit more about Simplify Asset Management. Now, you and our friend Harley Bassman both kind of changed jobs in order to go co-found this company, or were involved with other founders. What's it about, and why an ETF at this particular point in your career?
Yeah, so both Harley and I actually left to join a group of founders who had founded Simplify. Simplify is an ETF provider that is taking advantage of a significant change in the rules that governed ETFs and mutual funds that occurred in a combination of 2019 and 2020. The rule changes to the ETF rule, which is introduced in 2019, effectively made it much easier to introduce new and innovative products in the ETF space without a lengthy comment period. And so it's facilitated the growth of things like actively managed ETFs. We're trying to do things a little bit differently. The second rule change happened in late 2020. It was what's referred to as the derivative rule, and it facilitated the ability to include derivative strategies within ETFs in a way that hadn't been done before. There's efficiencies associated with this. It removes the requirement to have complex relationships with a brokerage firm in terms of things like ISDAs, right? So that's effectively a credit agreement that exists between a hedge fund or a very wealthy individual and a bank. Because of the introduction of the derivative rule, we're now able to include derivative overlays within products like an S&P 500 index fund that allows people to participate in the market. And many of your viewers have heard me talk about passive and the dynamics of how that's causing prices to rise. The growth of passive is causing prices to rise. Our objective is to take strategies that allow participation in that and effectively put a seatbelt on it, right? So protect against the more adverse conditions that people have heard me talk about.
Mike, we look forward to having you back in a few months for an update. Meanwhile, listeners, be sure to check out simplify.us for more information on Mike's ETF offerings. Patrick Serezna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. Escrow.com is the payment system for buying and selling anything of value. Cars, boats, airplanes, jewelry, gemstones, fine art, collectibles, intellectual property rights, domain names, bringing in shipping containers from overseas, or even buying and selling entire businesses. It's simple to use. Either party sets up the transaction, then the buyer sends the funds to Escrow.com. The seller is then instructed to send the goods to the buyer to inspect. Within the inspection period, the buyer can return the items for any reason. After that, Escrow.com pays the seller immediately. Escrow.com is the world's most secure payment system from a counterparty risk perspective because the funds sit in escrow. Over 2 million customers have transacted over $5 billion on Escrow.com, and eBay and Shopify use it for cars, boats, luxury watches, and business sales. It's available in the United States, Canada, and Australian dollars, euros, and British pounds. Never buy or sell anything online unless you use Escrow.com. Escrow.com is a subsidiary of Freelancer.com, listed on the OTCQX Best Markets under the ticker symbol FLNCF, and the Australian Securities Exchange under the ticker FLN.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Eric, great to have Mike back on the show. But now we're going to experiment with what might become a regular new segment, Eric's own editorial on a timely subject in finance. To kick this experiment off, Eric's editorial this week is on hyperinflation. Eric, take it away.
Last week, Twitter founder Jack Dorsey added his voice to the choir of ignorance, predicting hyperinflation of the U.S. dollar in the near future. Now, to be sure, Mr. Dorsey's command of macroeconomics is on par with that of Paris Hilton. So the grown-ups who actually understand such matters were never likely to have taken anything he said seriously. But he's a very prominent public figure, and he's contributing to a growing ignorance which absolutely will not help society to navigate the coming secular inflation. But what really scares me is not Jack Dorsey. What scares me is when the captains of finance, world-famous hedge fund managers, and institutional investors go on the cable networks and talk about how we're definitely headed for hyperinflation, and that hyperinflation might even be as bad as the hyperinflation we experienced back in the 1970s. Look, I'm going to make this simple, folks. Anytime that you hear anyone talk about the hyperinflation we had back in the 1970s, you should instantly recognize that you're dealing with a macroeconomic imbecile, a person who literally has no qualms going on CNBC or Bloomberg and pontificating on a subject such as hyperinflation without so much as bothering to acquaint themselves with the meaning of the word. It's shocking. And I would be tempted to criticize those networks' producers for inviting such idiots back on their channel. But, if I did that, I'm sure some of our more astute, longtime Macro Voices listeners might point out that I think we've even had a guest or two make that mistake, that astonishingly ignorant mistake, right here on Macro Voices. Now, look, I'm not trying to be a pedantic jerk and nitpick terminology. Secular inflation, something that really is coming, is a completely, totally different phenomenon than hyperinflation. They have little in common in terms of cause, and confusing the two phenomena is extremely dangerous because they're caused by completely different things that result in different outcomes. There was no hyperinflation or anything remotely related to hyperinflation in the United States in the 1970s, and there's no reason to expect or fear hyperinflation now. Now, don't get me wrong. I think we're headed for at least a decade of sustained high rates of consumer price inflation, almost certainly exceeding 10% per annum for several years and possibly exceeding 20% per annum for a few years as central banks around the world inflate away the purchasing power of their national debts, just as they did after World War II. And that inflation is really nothing more than an incredibly devious form of taxation, diluting the value of everyone's savings in order to make up for the government's past mistakes. Secular inflation is a period of many years during which too much money is chasing a limited supply of goods and services, causing prices to rise. In the present example, the source of the excess money will be central bank largesse, which has already fueled asset price inflation for the last decade. Now, don't get me wrong. Inflation is coming, and it's going to be a really big deal. I personally wouldn't be surprised if it's an even bigger deal than the inflation of the 1970s. But none of that has anything to do with hyperinflation, which is neither imminent nor likely if we're talking about the U.S. dollar. Hyperinflation is the wholesale loss of faith in a currency system. It's not about too much money chasing not enough goods and services driving up prices. That's regular inflation, and that's what we should be focused on because that is what's actually coming. There are several textbook definitions of hyperinflation. The most commonly cited one stipulates a minimum price appreciation rate of 50, that's 50%, not per year, but per month. That annualizes to well over 1,000% per year. And by that measure, not even the 2000 Argentine inflation, which reached annualized price appreciation rates over 80%, qualified as a true hyperinflation. And the American secular inflation and stagflation of the 1970s never came anywhere remotely close to that, never mind to actual hyperinflation. And that inflation was driven by factors completely different than those that drive a hyperinflation. These phenomena are completely different, and we need to stop confusing them. Hyperinflation is not about prices rising because too many people with money are competing for a limited supply of goods and services. Hyperinflation is when the general population loses faith in a currency system and is willing to do just about anything to avoid holding their savings in a currency they no longer trust and believe in. It happens when the entire currency system is failing, and the people who used to use it are finding alternatives. Examples are the recent Zimbabwe hyperinflation, when the government began printing trillion-dollar banknotes, which still wouldn't buy a loaf of bread, because nobody wanted or trusted Zimbabwe's official currency system. Another example is the Weimar hyperinflation that resulted from the German government printing way too much money trying to cope with the country's war reparation obligations after World War I. As a general rule of thumb, systematically important currencies such as the US dollar, the euro, the yen, and the British pound are effectively immune from hyperinflation unless something changes their systematically important status in the global economy. Am I saying that a US dollar hyperinflation is impossible? Well, of course not. Anything is possible, and I never say never. But let's talk about what it would take to actually bring that about. Now, if the US were to get into a shooting war with China and lose, and if that war outcome resulted in an entire world abandoning the US dollar as the global reserve currency, and all foreign central banks divested their US holdings, well, that would certainly be a ripe setup for a true US dollar hyperinflation to occur, as the American people lost faith in their government, and the government responded by panicking and printing too much money, trying to save the economy, in an environment where they no longer had that systemic importance of their currency system to the rest of the world to prevent it from hyperinflating. But what it would take would be for the American people to lose faith in their government and ditch their dollars in favor of euros or bitcoins or bullion or what have you. After World War II, it was actually cigarettes that became the principal currency in war-torn Europe when there was no banking system. But short of a major shock that unseats the U.S. government's command over its economy, U.S. dollar hyperinflation is almost impossible. Was Jack Dorsey really anticipating a war or other series of events which would completely unseat the U.S. from its current position of power in the world? Or is Jack just an idiot in a tie-dye t-shirt who people inexplicably take seriously for no apparent reason as he mouths off about something he obviously does not understand? I think that answer is obvious, but again, it's not Jack that worries me. We have people who are in charge of our pension funds and financial institutions running around using the words stagflation and hyperinflation interchangeably, as if they were synonymous. But again, I'm not trying to nitpick the terminology here. Look, if we're going to get through the coming secular inflation, we're going to need people in the finance industry who understand what the hell is really going on and why it's happening. But what we currently have in the ranks of the best and the brightest who run our financial institutions are macroeconomic imbeciles who, to any trained observer, have obviously never bothered to so much as read up on the most basic fundamental concepts of the different types of inflation and how they work and what the correct terminology is. So next time you hear anyone tell you that we're headed for hyperinflation just like the hyperinflation of the 1970s, don't take one more word they say on any subject seriously. You're dealing with an imbecile who uses loaded terminology without so much as bothering to acquaint themselves with the meaning of the vocabulary they profess to be expert on. Folks, please let us know if you want more editorials. We're thinking about a few ideas for sprucing up the show format, and the possibility of a weekly or monthly editorial is one of the ideas that we're toying with. Whether or not we do this again will depend on listener feedback. But right now, let's move on to Patrick's post-game chart deck, which is titled Going Parabolic. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your research roundup email. Now, that research roundup email may be delayed this week, so bear with us. It'll be out at some point on Thursday evening. If you don't have a research roundup email, just go to the homepage, macrovoices.com, click the red button that says Looking for the Downloads. Let's go ahead and take a look at the chart deck. You start off with a chart of the NASDAQ. What's going on?
Eric, I want to start off with the NASDAQ. Normally talk S&P 500, but it is really worth noting how the market really has accelerated, and particularly in the last few days has really started to almost feel a little parabolic in this rise. I put the trend lines not for predictive value, but rather just to identify the slope of the rise, and really shows how the market really has just taken off on the upside. And it really is interesting to see how far this will go. I mean, there's a lot of people that have played out that melt-up scenario and saying that that's the way the equity markets were going to finish this move. And really, that is now looking to be the case. The question now is how much gas is in the tank and how far can they take it? We'll be doing the play-by-play on this, but boy, is this a chart that's accelerated to the upside. So next here on page 3, I wanted to really touch on Tesla, because this is where that real parabolic price action can be really identified. It's not that there aren't other stocks out in the market that have this type of a parabolic move, but it's the fact that it's a $1 trillion market cap company that's doing it. And this move has just been phenomenal to the upside. The bears are being squeezed out, the shorts are being knocked out, and at the same time, all those call buyers and the huge call open interest is just grabbing at all that gamma on the upside, driving this parabolic move. I mean, when you see this type of acceleration, it's a bold thing to suggest that we know what price level this will stop. Arguably, when something goes parabolic like this, it could go to 1,500, it could go to 2,000. But bottom line of what I've seen in the past with these types of patterns is that they tend to blow off in a relatively reasonable time frame. And so while how much more upside there is in the coming week or two is something that we have yet to determine, it is likely that there is going to be some sort of a short-term blow-off top and a pretty meaningful mean reversion that comes on the other side as the profit takers kick in. One of the things I'll be looking for is when will there be a material and significant spike in implied volatilities, to particularly on the right end of the curve, to truly discourage call buying, further call buying, by simply making the options so expensive. It's certainly going to be something that's on my mind watching as we move forward. The last thing I wanted to touch on the equity charts was to have a quick peek at the Russell 2000. And what's particularly interesting about the small cap space is that while the S&P and NASDAQ have been generally trending all year, the small caps have been in a very tight sideways range bound market for the entire 2021 year, pretty much. And we just this week got the first technical breakout of this. And while that in itself is not a guarantee of anything, but usually when you have new highs developed this way, it draws a lot of attention. And certainly the overbought state that the market was at the start of the year has been completely unwound. It'll be really interesting to see whether or not this will mark the beginning of a new bull trend in the small caps and whether they'll participate on the upside.
Patrick, next you've got the Euro US dollar cross and crude oil. What's on your mind?
Well, Eric, I just wanted to give an update on this euro. We were looking at it last time as the ECB announcement was coming out, and it tried to pop higher, but really in the last week and then subsequently in the post-FOMC, we continue to see US dollar strength and the euro deteriorating back down to October lows. It'll be really interesting to see whether the support line holds. If it doesn't, I mean, that opens the window for the euro to head down to like 113 or 112 on the downside, and certainly that's a pretty significant overhead resistance on the dollar index itself. And so this is such an important currency to watch in my mind. And just touching on that crude oil chart, really what I wanted to highlight was simply that pop and drop that occurred today in that post-OPEC meeting period, with the fact that it tried to rally and then gave it back, really does increase the likelihood that we are now in the midst of some sort of mean reverting correction. And that doesn't in itself make crude oil bearish, but simply the likelihood now that it's going to consolidate some of this prior bull advance is certainly on the table. What I suspect is that this should be well defended during pullbacks, and I'm not looking for anything extraordinarily deep, but certainly this could be a prolonged multi-week process of backfilling and consolidation before the next buying opportunity emerges.
And listeners, you can get Patrick's chart decks every single day with a free trial of Patrick's service, Big Picture Trading. You find the information at bigpicturetrading.com or on page 7 of the slide deck. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Escrow.com, the world's most secure online payment system from a counterparty risk perspective, because the funds sit in escrow. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book we just discussed in the postgame. There's also a link to the Hoisington Quarterly Review and Outlook, and an article discussing taper rates, bond markets, and consequences. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, and we will consider it for our weekly distribution. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at MacroVoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. That's Eric spelled with a K, and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.